On Saturday night, October 27th, and Sunday afternoon, October 28th, the Des Moines Symphony is presenting their second Masterworks concert called On the Town. The program is part of the orchestra's 81st season called Junta Celebrates Bernstein. I'm Jacqueline Hallblum, and we're fortunate to have joining us today music director and conductor Maestro Joseph Junta. And thanks so much for joining us today, Maestro Junta.
It's always a pleasure, Jacqueline. Thank you.
So you are kicking off your On the Town concert with two works by Bernstein. So tell us about these three dances from On the Town.
First of all, it's just terrific music. It's such fun to play and work on with the orchestra. Obviously, On the Town was a musical that was written by Leonard Bernstein, and it's a great story about three American sailors that were docked at New York Harbor for a 24-hour shore leave, and takes place during World War II. And it's a terrific show, and Bernstein excerpted three excerpts from the show to use on the concert stage. The first movement is called The Dance of the Great Lover, which in the show is when one of the sailors falls asleep in Central Park and then dreams of meeting a beautiful woman and sweeping her off her feet. The second movement is the beautiful pas de deux from the show, where the sailor watches a scene in Central Park where another sailor meets a young girl and becomes involved. And this, by the way, is to the tune of Bernstein's Lonely Town, which is one of the most beautiful songs that he wrote. It's very nostalgic and very melancholy. And then the third movement is just a big romp. It's the Times Square Ballet, where it's a big cast number where everyone gets together and has a great time musically in Times Square. So it's a terrific piece, great orchestration, great modern orchestration, which includes fabulous E-flat clarinet solos and big alto sax solo, big trumpet solo. So it's a terrific way to start a program. These are really virtuoso pieces and a wonderful way to begin On the Town with music by Leonard Bernstein.
And in this, he was just in his early 20s, just getting started, and he blends in jazz and pop and the sounds, Copland-esque sounds and all sorts of things.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. You know, the man had so much talent and so much appreciation for the art form that he would have been equally comfortable, Jacqueline, playing in a bar in Tin Pan Alley after shows. He could have been a very capable Broadway conductor and pianist, and I mean it's remarkable. And actually, there's a wonderful story about when he became music director of the Philharmonic between 1958 and 1968, because of his interest in all kinds of music, just not classical music, but popular music, Broadway music. There was some people on the New York Philharmonic board at the time that took great offense at that and said, you know, how can somebody be taken as a serious musician if they play, you know, Gershwin and go to Tin Pan Alley and play in these bars until 4 o'clock in the morning. And he almost lost his job because of that. But how silly those people were back then, you know?
You mentioned Lonely Town being one of the brilliant works that he wrote. Well, also, there's a real famous tune that's part of this three dances from On the Town as well.
Yes, absolutely. New York, New York in the Last Movement is one of the great iconic American tunes and used, of course, on TV commercials. And for years, the New York Chamber of Commerce has used it for their tourism industry. So it's a great piece of music, and we're really happy to be playing it on these concerts.
Tell us about the next Bernstein work you're going to be performing.
This is a work that's new to the Des Moines Symphony. It's called Prelude, Fugue, and Riffs, and it was originally written in the late 1940s for the Woody Herman Band. And it's actually scored for solo jazz clarinet and jazz ensemble, jazz band. And it was dedicated to Betty Goodman. Now, the story goes, Jacqueline, that with Bernstein's eclectic tastes in both jazz and pop and rock and everything else that was going on at the time, he decided that he would write a piece that was primarily a jazz piece, but he considered it classical jazz. And later, in October of 1955, when the world premiere took place, he actually used this as a centerpiece on one of his young people's concerts. And he then talked about all these jazz terms that were unknown to people at that time: improvisation, syncopation, instrumental color, the addition of saxophones, and what that sounds like. And so he was brilliant at explaining how these sounds came about. And boy, it's just a great piece. It's in three movements. The prelude is for just the brass section, five trumpets and four trombones. And the second movement is called the fugue, which is just for the saxophone section and percussion. And then, of course, riffs is the last movement, which is solo clarinet, and everyone plays. It's a tremendous piece of music, and again, shows off his youthful and vital talent and how he felt about, you know, there should be no line between jazz or popular or commercial music. In his mind, it was either good music or bad music, and that's something that he taught me and something that I feel very strongly about.
Who will be appearing as your solo clarinetist?
His name is Greg Oakes. He's a professor of music at Iowa State University. He's our first principal clarinet player, and Greg is a brilliant musician. He has played in Carnegie Hall. He's played in the Denver Symphony. He's had an extensive background of playing in orchestras, and he refers to himself as a clarinet geek, meaning that he loves all things clarinet, and he's going to play this as well as any clarinetist in this country.
Now you're going to turn the corner and play some music of Mozart.
Yeah, you'd think that it would be unusual that we'd go from a modern, sort of fun, exciting, vibrant composer like Bernstein to someone like Mozart. But when you stop and think about it, you know, they really do have a lot in common. They both had a sense of humor. Their music shows this off. They were both highly innovative and used unusual orchestrations for many of their pieces. And they certainly were proteges. They certainly were people that from a very young time of their lives wanted to be musicians and were wonderfully talented. So this makes perfect sense for me. We're playing the Mozart Flute and Harp Concerto that was written in 1778. So Mozart would have been about 25 at the time. And what's interesting, Jacqueline, about Mozart in my mind is that, you know, by the time he was in his mid-20s, because of his father, Leopold, who was sort of his agent and kind of very interested in his son and daughter's education, they were both musical children, Mozart and his sister, and his father booked them in every major musical capital in Europe and London. And so he traveled from the time he was about 6 years old. He traveled to places like Rome and Paris and Vienna, and Naples, Zurich, I mean, London. I mean, so he really experienced a lot of culture, a lot of diversity, a lot of different languages. So he was quite experienced in dealing with people by the time he was in his mid-20s. And when he finally left Salzburg in his, 21 or 22, he really, after all that traveling as a teenager, really look for a place where he could settle in and experience one culture, and that happened to be Paris, and that's where he wrote this wonderful flute and harp concerto.
And who will be performing on this concerto?
We have two of our brilliant new generation musicians. Our principal flutist, Kayla Burgraff, has been in the orchestra now for three seasons. She is one of the premier flutists in our country these days. As a matter of fact, she's also a flutist with a New World Symphony that Michael Tilson Thomas conducts in Miami. She's brought a level of standard in flute playing here to Des Moines that's wonderful, and people are enjoying her playing very much. And she's not only a great musician, but also a wonderful person. And I could say the same thing about our second-year harpist, Aaron Brooker Miller. Aaron graduated from Indiana University with performance degrees in harp performance. She lives currently in Milwaukee with her husband, who's a percussionist there. But she comes to Des Moines to play our concerts. And she is a wonderful person, terrific musician. And between she and Kayla, they will play this as well as anyone can play it.
Now, is there a cadenza in this? Do these two play a cadenza in this concerto?
There is a cadenza, and the cadenza is interesting that you brought it up because many people have thought that they could improve on Mozart's original cadenza. He wrote, I believe, three different cadenzas at different times. And you have to remember, Jacqueline, that the harp as we know it today, the modern harp, wasn't really born until about 1810. So the harp is somewhat of a could be a flamboyant instrument with lots of glissandi and so on. But that was not the harp that Mozart knew. The harp that he knew was one that was sort of plucked as you would pluck the strings of a piano or even playing a harpsichord. So that's how this solo harp part sounds in this flute and harp concerto. And the flute, on the other hand, in the mid to late 1700s was a four-keyed flute. And then there was an advancement that made it a six-keyed flute. So this particular piece was written for the six-keyed flute, which is the next generation flute, which is a much better instrument, a vast improvement over the four-keyed flute. So this was a kind of a work in progress, and this cadenza was written as Mozart would hear this played. He would hear things that maybe the flutist and the harper could do differently or do better, and he would make adjustments with this. But lots of people wrote cadenzas for this piece, including the great André Previn, who, when he recorded it in London, he wrote the cadenza for it.
So let's talk about the last work, which is just a beautiful symphony.
I've tried to, as I program pieces for this season, Junda celebrates Bernstein, I've tried to not only include a piece or two of Bernstein's that he wrote on each program, but also pieces that were important to him. And certainly the composers of Mahler and Sibelius were extremely important to him. And I would go so far, Jacqueline, to say that if it wasn't for Leonard Bernstein, we may not be playing Mahler and Sibelius in this country. He brought both composers out of dormancy in the 1950s and is one of the reasons that they're in our standard repertoire today. But this music of Sibelius is just absolutely fantastic, in my opinion. And I can only think of one other composer that I know of, that when you hear maybe two or three wind chords, you know immediately that it's Brahms. And I feel the same way with Sibelius, that if you just hear 30 seconds of this music, that it doesn't take long before you realize that between the harmony and the way he scores things, that it's got the DNA of Sibelius like no other. Now, in my opinion, he was one of the four or five greatest symphonists that ever lived. Of course, your listeners know that he was a Finnish composer and certainly is well known as Finland's greatest composer even today. His music was often credited with giving Finland sort of a national identity because it had struggled for many years to seek its independence from Russia. And Sibelius's music, for some reason, connected with the public, and during his lifetime, he became so famous that he was referred to as the uncrowned king of Finland. You know, I have a framed photograph of the cover of Time magazine, December of 1937, and Sibelius is the photograph on that. And that's how famous he was, that he made the cover of Time magazine. And if any of your listeners had visited Finland before 2002, before the euro was adopted, they can tell you that on the Finnish 100 mark, that Sibelius's image was on there. So he was a true favorite son and a nationalistic hero.
Tell us just briefly about the symphony.
Well, this is maybe the greatest first symphony of any composer that I know. It certainly is right up there with the Mahler First Symphony, which we played at the start of our season. Sibelius started his first symphony in January of 1899, and it was very well received by the Helsinki public at the time. Like I said, this was the start of him becoming a national hero. Jacqueline, his two heroes musically were Tchaikovsky and Anton Bruckner. And he discovered their music when he was studying. He was never schooled in Finland, but he was studying in Berlin and in Vienna. And the beautiful melodies that we hear, these hummable melodies that are forever in your brain that we hear in this piece, is a limb from the Tchaikovsky tree. And the big brass chorales, the swells and diminuendos in the brass and wind writing, that's definitely out of Johann Sebastian Bach's Bible and then passed on to Anton Bruckner. So those are two important concepts when we're listening to Sibelius that we can think of, that he was influenced so much by Tchaikovsky and by Anton Bruckner. The first movement begins with a hauntingly beautiful solo clarinet. No other symphony begins like this. It has this sort of distant thunder timpani roll underneath of it. It's a very beautiful and broad and expansive movement. And that solo clarinet line comes back at the end of the piece, at the start of the fourth movement, and in a full sort of string sound. And that's basically the story of the piece, going from this distant, questioning mood to one that's fuller and has more people playing it. And the analogy would be that you go from one person that you convince that something's right politically, and then that one person goes to more friends and more friends. And that was kind of the concept that I believe Sibelius was building here. The second movement is just a beautiful variation form. It's a pieces. The first theme is very tragic and tender and distant, and it's just then morphs into a more conflicting section, and then, of course, ends very beautifully and peacefully. The third movement is a very brief but defiant scherzo, not so much like Bruckner's scherzo or a Beethoven scherzo, but this is more defiant. The timpani is very prominent in this movement, and it sounds just sort of like gunshots at times. And then the last movement, as I said, that beautiful clarinet theme comes back to start that last movement with full fiery and furiousness of the strings. And shortly after that, there's a wonderful dominant folk dance that builds into quite a frenzy before the mood is interrupted by this dark and sort of brooding but yet beautiful coda. I believe, as I said earlier, that it's one of the best first symphonies that anyone has written, and always thrilled to be able to conduct Sibelius's first symphony.
Maestro Giunta, how can folks get more information and tickets for this On the Town Masterworks 2 concert?
Ticket information is available on our website, which is dmsymphony.org, or the Civic Center box office is always a good place to go, and tickets should be available right up until 30 minutes or so before each concert.
And that's Saturday, October 27th at 7:30 p.m., Sunday, October 28th at 2:30 p.m. at the Civic Center of Greater Des Moines. And thanks for today's interview goes to Chris Fenton and Alexis Hahn, and a big thanks to Maestro Joseph Giunta, who is celebrating his 30th anniversary this year with the Des Moines Symphony Orchestra. And thank you so much for joining us today, Maestro Giunta.
My pleasure. Thank you, Jacqueline.